You know, last week Matthew provided us with the proof of the Messiah's lineage. That's what his purpose was last week. Hey, I want to prove to you that through this whole lineage from Abraham to Jesus, that he is the Messiah. So he wanted to show us that, and we took a peek back to Matthew or Luke that took us all the way back to Adam, but establishing the link to Abraham and the tribe of Judah to David are essential proofs to declare that Jesus Christ is the promised Christ or the promised Messiah in the scripture. So he wanted to establish that right off the bat. In chapter 2, he wants to connect us to the prophecies that predicted some of this stuff. There's a number of little tiny prophecies in here. You're going to see that all the way through the book, but in particular in the beginning of Matthew, we see kind of the essential proofs of these prophecies. You know, it was written in, something like that in the book of Matthew. Matthew's gospel, remember, is a Jewish gospel. It is written to a Jewish audience. It's written generically to everyone, but definitely has a Jewish overtone to it. And if you were familiar with the Jewish traditions and scriptures, these prophecies would fit into a messianic form. You would understand these things. You're waiting for the Messiah. Every woman of Israel, the Jewish women, especially the tribe of Judah, they were waiting. Could I be the one that bears the Messiah? Different things like that. So chapter 2 confirms the birth of Jesus at Bethlehem. He was predicted to be born in this little tiny town. It's like a little town in the middle of nowhere. You know, I mean, Mantino, smaller than Mantino or something like that. You know, a little tiny town of insignificance. So we see that. We see that he's born in Bethlehem. We see an early attempt of his life by Herod. As a baby, as just a newborn, Herod is coming after him. I want to talk a little bit about spiritual warfare at the end of this sermon here. We see the visit of the wise men. Remember years ago, I always like this, there was a garage door in, I think it was in Bedford Park or somewhere in the south suburbs, big old garage door, and it says, "Wise men still seek him." Do you ever hear that term? I thought, that's a good little saying there, you know. But we're going to speak about the wise men or the magi. We're going to see the slaughter of the innocents. They went after Jesus, but in their way was a bunch of babies. So then we're going to look at the flight into Egypt and then the return to Galilee where Jesus spends his childhood, probably the first 30 years of his life he spent up in Nazareth. Chapter 2 in Matthew covers an entire 30 years of the life of Jesus in kind of just a few breaths. It's not really that detailed. We'll have other detail in other Gospels, but Matthew's not concerned about those kind of details. He's concerned about the prophecies, concerned about the messianic link. He's concerned about speaking to the Jews that this is, in fact, the Messiah. In brief, though, to the point, and the springboard is the, we're going to go into the baptism next week of chapter 3. So I didn't want to go too much further in that. Matthew omits a lot of the supernatural visits, like the Gabriel to Mary and different things. He kind of omits that. Now, we'll see Joseph has a few dreams, but he omits a lot of that. He omits, you know, to Elizabeth, to, you know, different things that he just omits those things. Those are going to be covered in other Gospels. You know, God's got it all covered. Those four Gospels has everything that we need to know about Jesus. But he's more concerned about matching the Old Testament scriptures with what is happening in the current events of his days. That's what he's trying to bring that out. You know, Mark, each of the Gospels are so different. They have a different flavor. Now, if God was to pick out four of us here to tell a story, all of us would focus on something a little different. We would tell the story, but I might say, you know, hey, there was a blue car involved in that. And someone else might say, you know, that man, he had a hat, something like that. You know, that's the way the Gospels are. They speak to us in that way. Mark focuses on the supernatural. If you ever get into Mark, it's like it happens, and then the demons and the healings, and I mean, it's real. It's kind of a machine gun gospel. It's really quick and it's really to the point. Luke focuses. He's concerned about historical history, and he's a historian by nature, and he puts even dates and in the sense of matching the times with the rulers or the places, different things like that. And John's gospel, it focuses on the divinity of Christ. It really does. So Matthew is content to promote Jesus as the promised Messiah. That's what he's going to do all the way through this. We have some exciting chapters ahead of us. The Sermon on the Mount, you know, the prophecies in chapter 24 and 25 of the end of the world, all those different things. And all the good principles kind of sandwiched in between all of that stuff. So we got a lot to look forward to in the months ahead as we go through this gospel. So today our outline is just the birth of the Messiah. And then I put down on the run. They're on the run because Herod is chasing them. And that's part of this chapter itself. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." You know, the Christmas cards and the nativity scene have kind of perpetuated the myth. There's a myth behind all of this, that the wise men were there at the birth, but we know that, that's not true. I kind of like the myth itself. You know, I remember I was in a, this was in a public school too. I was in a play, a Christmas play in a public school, and they chose me to be one of the shepherds in there. You know, they actually had Jesus on the stage in those days, you know. Not anymore. It just doesn't happen anymore. Maybe an atheist or two, you know, throwing some bombs at the Christians, but not, you know, it just doesn't happen. You know, the Christmas cards kind of perpetuate the myth. The clean hay, right? The real clean hay. The tidy manger, well-organized kind of half circle around the crib. You know, the shepherds kneeling before Jesus. The three kings kind of completing that half circle. And Mary sporting that virtuous blue and white gown, you know, spotless. Never resembling somebody that just delivered a baby in a barn, you know, never that. So Joseph, he's off to the side, but he's visible, you know. How different, though, the birth of God was. The birth of God was in reality. It was a barn. It was a barn. And barns have familiar odors, right? And barns don't smell real clean. The hay probably not as clean as you would want or you would imagine. The manger, you know, we call it a manger, euphemisms for it was an animal trough full of saliva and spit and hay and whatever else happened in there. It was not very hygienic at all. For someone that had created trillions upon trillions of stars and billions of galaxies that we are just discovering, the Bethlehem scene was kind of disappointing, wasn't it? Or was it? Was it really? God had planned all this. He had planned everything in it. You know, let's consider a few things surrounding the birth of God. First, he was born in a barn. If he left the door open, Mary could have said, "What, are you born in a barn?" "Yes, I have been born in a barn." When you think about, though, the deliberate choices of God that God made, you know, he could have actually waited till the 21st century, have Terrence build a clean white hospital. That's what he does for a living. And Jesus could have been born there, right? In a very hygienic, really, he could have had his own room, right? He could have had his own room. But God chose to be born in a barn. And it's not a very fancy place, and it's not a very fancy birth when you look at it. You see the celebrities of this world. They have a baby and it's broadcasted all over, and the people are trying to get snapshots of it just, you know, to see the Prince of Wales, any of that stuff. They're trying to get all the snapshots of it, and the media reports it as being a big thing. If they were born in a barn, they would not be broadcasting those things. It was not a it was not a special day. You know, I once lent my car to in an emergency situation to a friend that his wife was about to have a baby. Well, she did have the baby in my car, and it made the news. It really made the news. She was born on 95th, and we used to call her Kedzie, 95th and Kedzie. On her way to Christ Hospital, she didn't make it, and she had the baby in the front seat of my brand-new Scotch-guarded car, I might say. So it was kind of interesting. But it made the papers, you know. This would have never made the news, ever. It's this little tiny shack in Bethlehem. Most of those things were caves, the little barns that they had. Being born in a barn isn't something you necessarily, you don't boast about it, but it does reveal the nature of God coming into the world to save sinners like all of us. He came humbly. He didn't come in a flash of lightning or anything like that. Though he was a king, he was not born as a like a king, right? He was born as kind of a poor person, somebody that really didn't have a lot. You know, the true nature of God is humility as a servant. That's what he is. He's the greatest of all. He says the greatest servant of all, the greatest of all is the servant of all, and he was the greatest of all because he was the servant of all. But let's consider the guest list. You know, Matthew doesn't deal with the details of the birth of Jesus, but Luke tells us that the only guest invited to the birth was shepherds. Now, you think, oh, that's all right. Shepherds were petty thieves. They were petty thieves. They were not really considered the high point of society. You know, you wanted to have your hand on your wallet if you were hanging around with them for any length of time. They had a reputation for being, you know, just thieves itself. The other guest we see on the Christmas card was the wise men, or what we call the Magi, but in actuality, they did not arrive for maybe almost up to 2 years. We're not really sure exactly when they did arrive. It could have been just months afterwards. We do see a difference in the location when they do show up. We have no idea how many they were. We float the number three because of the gifts. That's all, you know, the three gifts that they gave out. But they were probably in a great caravan. I mean, a lot of people in a great caravan. You know, we sing that song, what? We three kings of Orient are. I mean, that's, we don't know. We don't know how many there were. Now, these Magi, who were they? You know, we can gather from history that they were probably Persian by nature. They were probably Persian. Possibly dispersed Jews who remained in Persia after the Babylonian return of the Jews. They could have been actual Jews that stayed in Persia when they went into captivity. But what we do know about the Magi, historically, they dealt in the sciences, they dealt in the arts, in the medicine, they dealt in astrology, and even in the occult itself. They read the stars. That's why they followed this star. They were monotheistic, and they believed in one God, but not necessarily the God of Abraham. It just depends on who these people were. We don't know exactly who showed up. They were around the time of Daniel, about 500 years before the birth of Christ. They were influential in the political and the religious issues. Daniel might have mingled with these guys when he was in power there, you might say, as a counselor. There's some indication that they were aware of the biblical prophecies. We'll see that in a minute, of the Messiah, possibly through the influence of Daniel. It could have been through the influence of Daniel. Daniel made a big splash in Babylon and a big splash in Persia, and he had a good reputation. So could have been that he himself had given these guys, or given that group, kind of information on the messianic birth. But the birth of Jesus Christ, the Messiah of Israel, was not a surprise in these days if you were a biblical student. It was not a big surprise. There was, at this time in Israel, almost a kind of like what we have now. Everybody's, you know, at least people that are in the Bible thinking, this could be the last days. You know, because we're looking at the Bible and we're studying it and we're comparing it to what we know about the last days. Back then, they were expecting the Messiah around that time. They had an expectation. It was a very messianic type of tone in Israel itself. And it was predicted precisely, and I'm going to kind of be brief on this. If you want to know more about this, I can talk to you personally, but to get into the details of it, it would take too long. It was predicted precisely in chapter 9 of Daniel that the general time of the Messiah would arrive, and it would be during the time of Matthew's gospel, right when he's writing it, or before he wrote it. Daniel 9:25 says this. Now, I don't expect you to really understand all of it, but some of you guys have been gone through Daniel. You know what I'm talking about. This is on the prediction of the Messiah when he would come. He says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to rebuild or restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah the Prince," the command to restore was issued by a Persian king, and I'll give you some dates on it in a second, to restore Jerusalem and until Messiah the Prince, "there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, even the walls, even in troublesome times." Now that is a prediction exactly of the time of the Roman, kind of the Roman occupation of Jerusalem. Now some of you might be familiar with this particular prophecy as we went through the book of Daniel. So without getting into a great deal of explaining, this particular prophecy designates the arrival of the Messiah, when he was going to come, okay? So, and it's a calculation from the time Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, when he gives the command, he let Nehemiah and these other guys go back to rebuild Jerusalem. He gives the command, from that time, the clock starts, until the time of the prince, or Messiah the prince, that's when it's going to be. We know that that happened on March 5th, 444 B.C. So we got a starting point, right? Then you look at the book of Daniel and understand that the deciphering of the 69 weeks, he put 7 weeks and 62 weeks, that's 69 weeks. And if you multiply that times 7, it equals 483 years. Like I said, if you really want more information, get me afterwards. But this is this is something that we went through in Daniel. But you take that 483 years and you multiply that times 360 days in the solar calendar. That's what they used back then. If you multiply that, you get 173,880 days. So from the point that he gives the command to rebuild Jerusalem, add 173,880 days, you get to the date of April 6, 32 AD, the day Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the donkey. That's the first time he really is announced as the Messiah to Israel. It's kind of an amazing thing. So here's the point. They were expecting the Messiah around this time. They were expecting the Messiah. And the expectations in those days was the arrival of the Messiah could be any day. It could be any time. It was just there was a fervor in the air during that. So they were looking for the Messiah. So when Herod hears this in verse 3, he says, "When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled and all Jerusalem with him." You know, this kind of indicates that this Magi was not just three guys. This is a big party coming into town. It was a big arrival. So there's this great stir in Jerusalem about the Magi's arrival with the news that the Messiah had been born. So Matthew now introduces us to Herod. This is Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the guy that built the temple in Jesus' day, or the temple that Jesus went into. It was pretty much completed by that. He's the same one that built the temple. He was a brutal man. The whole Herod family was not a good family. Very dysfunctional. He killed his wife. He killed his two sons. And it was said, you probably heard me say this before, it's better to be a pig than to be one of Herod's sons. That's what the kind of the little cliche that went around during those years. Herod was not a Jew, but he proclaimed himself to be king of the Jews, and Rome went along with that as long as there was kind of a peace in that region. So the news that the Magi brought to Herod was threatening. Here's another king. This is the king of the Jews. I'm the king of the Jews. Who's this baby? So that arrival of the Messiah, the news of the Messiah, was very threatening to Herod. It was, you know, Herod gathers all of these chief priests and the priests together to find out exactly when or where the Messiah would be born. Verse 4, it says, "And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So they said to him, 'In Jerusalem,' or 'In Bethlehem of Judea. For thus it is written by the prophet, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are you not the least among the rulers of Judah? For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" So that's a prediction. Actually, that's out of the book of Micah, back in the Old Testament, chapter 5, verse 2. So you had the birth in a barn, right? You had this birth in the barn. The guest list was questionable. The shepherds, a small town of insignificance. Bethlehem was not a big town. It was not a famous town. Verse 7, "Then Herod, who had secretly called the wise men, determined from them what time they saw what time the star appeared." So, you know, we're going to find out it's about a couple of years they've been following this sign. "And he sent them to Bethlehem and says, 'Go and search carefully for the young child. And when you have found him, bring back word to me, for I might come and worship him also.'" Well, we know Herod's goal in this was to destroy the child. The star that they followed, we call it the Bethlehem star, but it kind of remains a mystery today. They don't know if it was some kind of comet that was, they just don't know, a planetary alignment. They've come up with a bunch of theories on it. We know that they had followed this for the last few years. Now, Herod inquires when they first saw them. There's the reason behind that. And Herod's motive was to find out about the child, not to worship, but to kill Jesus. Verse 9, "But when they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star, which they had seen in the east, went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was." To me, it's some kind of miracle. It's a miracle. I mean, you know, God can, he made the star. He can kind of move it around if he wants, right? "When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding joy. And when they had come into the house," notice it's no longer the barn, but they're in a house now, "they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh." That's where we kind of get the three kings. But notice in verse 11, they're in a house. Things are settled down. They're not on the, you know, on the eve of the birth anymore. It's not like that. The barn days are over. They're more settled in this little town. As far as reporting back to Herod, God gives them a dream for them to, you know, depart from another way, go another route altogether. Verse 12, it says, "Then, being warned," or divinely warned in a dream, "that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way." And like I said, we think it's Persians. We think they're the Persians. That's where the Magi's kind of came out of. Now we're going to see that Jesus is on the run with his parents. His parents are on the run protecting him. Verse 13, "Now when they departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, 'Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring word for you, or I bring you word. For Herod will seek the young child to destroy him.' And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt. And there was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, 'Out of Egypt I have called my son.'" Now, this particular prophecy is a comparison between Jesus and the nation of Israel. If you go back, when God, with Moses, God called Israel out of Egypt. There's these dual prophecies in the Bible, and you have to understand, sometimes there's these dual prophecies. They mean something different in the day, like back then, this particular one, out of Egypt I called my son, it really refers back to God taking Israel out of Egypt itself. But there's a lot of dual prophecies in the Bible. And when I say dual, I mean that it's compared to something that happens right currently, but it's going to be extended in the future too. It's going to have this kind of this dual meaning. In this particular case, such as Israel as a nation being called out of Egypt with the days of Moses. And the other portion being futuristic to another day, such as Jesus being called out of Egypt after the death of Herod. And it's also a pattern. We see patterns in the Bible that, you know, they're built into the Bible that would in the future would reference Jesus Christ. We know when Jesus talked about the Bible, he says, you know, you look at all those things and they testify of me. Everything in the book testifies of Jesus Christ. So now verse 16, it says, then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, they were wise, so they did cut out another route, right? He was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and its districts from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. So these wise men, they had told them, look, we saw the star a couple years ago. So what Herod does, he kind of blankets Bethlehem, the surrounding probably even smaller villages in that area, and anything that was 2 years old and younger, he killed. That's the kind of man he was. He was just an evil man. There's other implications behind this, though, spiritual implications, going after the Christ child. You know, Jesus came to die, but not by this way. He came to die to shed his blood for us as a sacrifice. So, you know, last week we discussed the genealogy of the lineage of Jesus Christ. And one of the interesting things that you'll notice along the way, if you're into the Bible, is that in parts of the genealogies that you follow, and last week we talked about from Abraham to Jesus, the many instances where Satan attempts to destroy the lineage. You know, you think about it. Jesus was a target of Satan even as a child. But if he could not destroy the lineage that produced the child, he would destroy the child itself. That's what it was. But there's many attempts in the Bible to destroy the lineage or to derail the plans of God. Everything that you see, all the spiritual warfare that you see in the Bible, everything is to derail the plans of God. That's what it is. He's working against us all the time. You know, we see it in Moses' days. What? Pharaoh attempts to what? Destroy what? All the male children. See? And I mean, that would, if they hit the right person in that lineage, they would destroy that, you know? Satan was a Bible scholar. He knew what the Bible says about all these things. So all the male children. We see in the Assyrian and then the Babylonian captivity that they were so intermingled, they began to intermingle so much with the foreign wives and different things like that, that to water down or dilute the messianic line. There's things like that. We see in Esther's time that Haman instigates a plot to wipe out the Jewish race. All those things, you know, we think they just didn't like the Jews. No, there's more to that. There's spiritual backing behind that to derail the plans of God. Now we see it in Herod's times. He's destroying all the male children in Bethlehem. You know, he was influenced by Satan himself. That's what it is. He's influenced. He himself was an evil man, capable of carrying out evil deeds, but the influence was coming from the dark side of those dark angels, Satan and all that. So Herod's time, he tries to destroy the male children in Bethlehem, kind of snuffing out the messianic line. Notice the children, though, they were 2 years old and younger. This is how long the Magi were tracking. That's why we can say when they arrived at that house, Jesus could have been up walking around, you know, even, you know, taking his first words. You know, he could have been a 2-year-old child. So we're not really sure. But even this, we see another dual prophecy here, when, because he kills all of the male children, it says that was fulfilled, that was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentations, weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because there are no more. It's out of Jeremiah 31:15, Rachel being Israel. The original text in Jeremiah was about the grief and mourning of the Jewish mothers at the time of the conquest of the captivity of, into Babylon. There was a lot. There was a great slaughter on the remnants in Jerusalem itself. So you have that prophecy, or not prophecy, that actual word back then. But then you have this future prophecy that Matthew brings us into. But Rachel here is a picture of Bethlehem's mothers. So we get that dual prophecy. You'll see that a lot in the Old Testament. You'll see a prophecy. You know, David will be, all of a sudden, he'll be reciting something that could be happening to him. But later on, it's really what's happening to the Messiah itself. So you see all that that dual prophecy stuff. Now, when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead. Then he arose and took the young child and mother and came to the land of Israel. But when he had heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. After being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside to the region of Galilee. And we do have some prophecies about that area. They're going to see a light in that area. That's one of the prophecies. He doesn't mention that in here. So this Herod Archelaus, he was the son of Herod the Great. He was brother to Herod Antipas. We'll see him a little bit later. And then if you remember Herod Philip, we'll see him in the book of Acts. Now, he only reigned a short 8 years, and he committed suicide. He did some kind of stupid things. He rattled up the Jews. He put, you know, the eagle was the Roman insignia. He put it at the front of the temple. It riled up everybody. You know, the Jews got really riled up about it. Eventually, Rome banished him by the Romans, and he eventually committed suicide. So when Joseph returns to Israel, because he feared this man, he thought, well, like father, like son. And they were. All the Herods were just kind of crazy. You know, it's interesting. I think about the aristocracy of that day in the Roman days, and even in Israel itself, the hidey-tidey ones, you know, the aloof ones, they ate off of lead plates. That's not a good idea. I mean, think about. We know what happens with children and ingesting kind of lead paint. We know that their intelligence is shortened, and we know that that's what they did. That was their all. The big thing is they were eating off a lead plate, so they could have added to their cuckoo-ness, you know. So he only reigned a short time. But Matthew tells us, instead of, he comes into Israel because he still feared this man when he came in, he headed north to Galilee, which is north of Jerusalem. And verse 23, and he came and he dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled that he was spoken by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. Now, a Nazarene was a holy man. That's what it was. He took a vow, didn't cut his hair. Samson was a Nazarene for a period of time. So, this particular one is back in the Old Testament. More of a type than a direct prophecy. So he's born in a barn, questionable guest on the guest list, on the run most of his early life, and he settles in Nazareth, which, by the way, it itself had a very bad reputation. you know, the town itself. Some towns just have a bad reputation, you know, altogether. And Chicago's getting to be that way. Bad reputation with all the murders and stuff. So, but Nazareth was kind of a, I mean, the chief priest and all that, they said, well, he's from Nazareth. You know what that town is like, you know. Just, it wasn't a great little town. Interesting that he chose all these things, though. From the foundations of the world, he chose to be born in a barn. He chose to be, you know, to have those people at his birth and all the different things that happened in his life. You know, all those things were chosen ahead of time. They weren't random events. But not a great way to start off your life if you're on the run all the time. But all of it was purposed by God and predetermined before the foundations of the world, when you think about it. So, you know, we've been talking about the early years of Jesus, or the birth of God, the birth of the Messiah on the run. I mean, he was on the run. Jesus was really on the run his whole life, when you think about it. I mean, he was always kind of dodging bullets. Remember, they wanted to throw him off the cliff one time, and he kind of walked right through them, and that was kind of magical. You know, I love the fact that Jesus chose to be born in a barn, in a humble state, humble family, humble little town, couple towns. But it tells me something about the nature of God, the humility of God, the, you know, the servant nature of Jesus Christ. We're going to see that all the way through the Gospels itself. Now, next week, we're going to get into the ministry of Jesus, beginning with his baptism. But I want to close a little bit, and I think it's important, what struck me in this particular chapter. It's important for all of us to understand, all of us here that are Christians have a target on our back. All of us do. All of us have that target on our back. And that target is from the enemy itself. And when I speak about enemies, I speak about supernatural evil forces that go against us. Now you say, well, I don't believe in that. Well, the Bible differs on that thought. The Bible promotes that thought. And to even think that way, to be going against the kind of the logic of the scriptures itself. If you are a Christian, you have a target painted on your back. You know, God has a purpose for you in your life, and he wants to complete that purpose, and Satan wants to derail you. That's what he wants to do. He wants to derail you as a person. And it's not coincidental that the things that happen in your life, you know, while you're seeking the Lord, your devotions, your prayer life, coming to Bible study, you know, showing up in church, it's not coincidental. Do you ever notice on a Sunday morning? Now, this happened a lot more when we were raising our kids. All of a sudden, something would come up, a fight along the way, you know, something to kind of really derail your whole mind thinking about just receiving from the Lord. It always happens on a Sunday morning. I don't know what it is, you know. It just happens, and it's not a coincidence. Those arguments that you have with your spouse before church, little things like that. You know, if the lineage of Jesus Christ is attacked in history, you can bet that you're going to be attacked as a person, because God wants to complete the work in you. Satan wants to derail the work in you. That's the warfare that we experience, you know. Jesus was threatened as a child, and we see that that threat is carried all the way over through the Gospels, all the way to the cross, really, and that was a willing submission. But you can bet whatever belongs to God, and if you belong to God, you're going to be a target. You're going to be a target. It's just, it, you know, you can't discount that. Now, we don't have to walk out of here fearing like the devil's going to jump out from under every rock. I'm not into that. That's kind of crazy, you know. But you can bet that there are supernatural things. Try praying for a solid week at a certain time. Phone rings, your thoughts drift, something happens, you got to talk to somebody, you got to do this, got to do that. Believe me, there's warfare going on all around us. So you can bet whatever belongs to God is open to spiritual warfare to the enemies of God. And if you belong to God, you have these principalities and powers in high places that are coming against you in some way or another, you know, and it's not coincidence. But here, the Bible says we're not ignorant of his devices. We're not ignorant of Satan's devices. So to be up on that, to be aware of it, that when you go to seek the Lord, that you're going to have someone's going to run interference, and it's going to be some invisible force in your life. So be aware of that. Be aware of the hindrances that he puts in your path. He works against God and the people of God. That's what he does. He wants to destroy all that. And to me, it's just a matter, you got to fight the good fight. You got to push through that because he's not going to stop at anything to put you in neutral. Satan does two things. He either wants to destroy your life, or if he can get you in neutral, that's good for him, because then you're kind of coasting. We fight the good fight, and that's what we have. That's what God wants us to be involved in that. So greater is he that's in us, right, than he that's in the world. Amen.